topic will be a little bit broader than a case study, a single case study, as we had in the morning. And the issue of instability is also rather abstract, so I have to narrow it down a bit. So my talk will concern, well, not any instability, but instabilities which threaten the political community as such. So yesterday we had this talk that, well, secession, for instance, is one such problem which puts in question the fate of political communities. So my focus will be on such more existential types of instability, because instability is anyhow built in many of the contemporary political regimes. And I'm going to look at various factors of constitutional nature which might have a certain impact on such instability, or they might have either stabilizing role or destabilizing role. And I will try to draw some conclusions, but I have to warn you that my conclusions will not be very, very conclusive, because it's difficult to discern stable patterns, especially when you are considering a set of complex factors. So I'm going to speak about generally six factors, and my talk will be rather telegraphic and brief, but I want to focus on the choice between parliamentarism, presidentialism, and semi-presidentialism. What we can learn by looking very broadly at Eastern Europe about such choices. Second, power sharing mechanisms, majoritarian versus more complex decision-making formulae, like the supermajorities, quota mechanisms, and so on. Third, a factor which I broadly call European integration, but here we have to add other organizations as well, NATO, the Council of Europe to a degree, and so on, European integration. Fourth, the nature of the electoral system. Fifth, the nature of the political parties. And sixth, protests as an expression of civil society and alternative forms of representation of the people. So what kind of impact they have on political systems, constitutional regimes, and so on. And let me start with parliamentarism versus presidentialism and semi-presidentialism. So a lot has been written, and Andrew mentioned various authors who have spoken about this, so I'm not going to say anything innovative on that. But at first blush, when you look at the map, in fact, the more stable, the more efficient constitutional models in the region seem to be parliamentary. They're more on the western part, and semi-presidentialism has experienced more instability. If you look at it. So we can try to have an explanation about this, and I encourage you in the discussion to think about possible reasons. But at least at first blush, there are we can say this, that there is a presumption in favor of greater stability in the parliamentary models that that we find. Of course, there are exceptions on both sides. And of course, it is difficult to interpret developments in Russia, this super presidential type of regime, which probably created, super stability in a sense, but it also destroyed any remnants of pluralism that the system had. Well, any probably is exaggeration. Still, there are some remnants of pluralism, but Russia of the 1990s, Yeltsin's Russia, looked much more democratic than what we have now. Now in the region, and not to speak of experiments in Central Asia with presidential models, which are clearly kind of authoritarian in their nature. So if we have to draw a conclusion, it seems that the stability in presidential, super-presidential regimes has been reached, yes, but at the expense of democracy, in a sense. So there is this choice, which is rather unpleasant, which emerges. And as Andrew spoke about Ukraine, the better solution, in his view, was the constitution of 2004-2006, which introduced a more parliamentary form, parliamentarized form of government, again with due executive and so on, but with more emphasis on the parliament. So, at least from this perspective, the Ukrainian story supports this conclusion. So I put it there. I know it's a much more complex debate, but in terms of very, very broad brush generalizations, I would stand by these points. Secondly, about power sharing and majoritarian decision making, what have we learned on the basis of the experience of generally models in Eastern Europe? Power sharing models, models with extensive power sharing, have been introduced in some post-war, post-conflict countries and situations. So Bosnia is an obvious example, with very complex system of power sharing, three units of quasi-state nature within something which is called federation. Most of the experts, most of the people agree that this model doesn't function very well, that it is sustainable only because of outside factors, help from European Union, NATO, and other mostly this actually, but without kind of substantial foreign help in United States and so on, this model would hardly be sustainable on its own. It might actually lead to a situation when you have not a political community at all. More successful case we have in Macedonia, where a very serious conflict was avoided in the beginning of the 2000s. And then there was an Ohrid agreement. It led to certain power sharing deals between the Macedonian majority, Albanian minority, including a long list of institutional arrangements, also quotas for representation in the police, and so on and so forth. This has worked, it seems, better. There have been other countries. In fact, my own country, Bulgaria, in the beginning of the 1990s, was considered one of the most vulnerable to ethnic conflict, because at the end of the communist regime, there was an attempt. Not an attempt. They did it. The government changed the names of all people of Turkish origin in Bulgaria. So overnight, almost, they received Slavonic names. And this was a kind of, major violation of rights, major source of conflict between minority and majorities. And Bulgaria started the process of dismantling the communist regime, establishing liberal democracy and so on, with this problem to solve, which was quite significant. The Bulgarian experience, however, was not based on complex forms of power sharing. So what was decided in terms of constitutional arrangement was a more or less majoritarian form of parliamentary democracy with proportional representation. What happened was that the Turkish minority got represented in parliament, and since then its party has become quite influential. So in many circumstances they have been kingmakers, they have had the swing vote. So they're the party which has most often been in parliament, in government, excuse me. They're always in parliament, but they're the party that has most often been in government. So this proved to be a kind of very working mechanism, and despite this very troubling legacy of ethnic conflict, actually now nobody really talks about these issues, at least internationally. So we do have our debate at home about the model, but at least it is not flagged as a serious model. So what we can say? Again, it's a very broad brush statement, but it seems that the more lasting solutions they do not presuppose very complex power-sharing instruments, especially power-sharing instruments which lead to potentially to disintegration of the community, as in Bosnia, because the price it seems very high. Yes, you have the two communities on board. But if they're so devolved, if powers are so devolved, this is actually a nominal state which is held together only just by external factors. So this seems a kind of balance which emerges. Now there was an interesting case of Hungary. Hungary doesn't have an ethnic conflict internal which can threaten the country. But there was a form of very extensive power sharing between government and the opposition, because the Hungarian constitution was elaborated in such a way as to make many important laws to be adopted by two-thirds majority. So you have to have, in fact, agreement of the opposition in order to adopt major laws. And interestingly, in the 1990s, this was considered to be one of the reasons for the Hungarian success, because in Hungary there was a very broad consensus on key elements of the transition, and the elites were somehow united upon important political topics, and this mechanism of power sharing was strengthening the consensus. If you look at Hungary now, this mechanism works in a slightly different way. Because there was a party emerging which through one instrument or another manages to control two-thirds majority, so in fact, instead of stabilizing and instead of building broad political consensus, this instrument works in furthering divisions, political divisions, in a way. So, and marginalizing the opposition, now is feeling kind of weak and disempowered by the constitutional arrangement. And not surprisingly, so there are extra parliamentary forms of mobilization, protests, movements, and so on against the internet tax or this and that emerged. So this is another kind of a trade-off that could be also discussed. Now, third, and again in this telegraphic way, European integration. And well, this is a big issue. We can discuss the impact, the effect. There has been a lot of criticism how the European Union engaged, especially with countries, countries which are now members, and also countries which are potential members. So there is this asymmetrical relationship. It's pretty much one-way street, at least in the countries of Central Europe. It was conditionalities, imposing conditionalities. You have to meet this, take it or leave it. Very few opportunities for negotiation or to kind of amendments and so on. For instance, the whole acquis communautaire had to be transposed, implemented without major revisions, which created a huge transplantation. Led to a huge transplantation exercise in Central Europe and so on. And you could argue to what extent this is effective in a way of creating really working institutions and so on. So I take on board all these criticisms. In fact, I have raised myself certain criticisms of this type about the superficiality, formality of some of these arrangements and exercises. But after all, we have to grant that European integration has had also extremely positive stabilizing role in especially countries which have been fully integrated in the European Union. And this role how shall I put it? So simply there are red lines which domestic political elites are not able to cross. Well, so they can possibly do mischief of various sorts, but still there are certain lines which they cannot cross, and this is, I think, quite significant. Andrew in the morning said that one of the big problems of Ukraine is the nature of the political class. So if we assume that this is a valid explanation, and I think it has currency not only in Ukraine but in other countries as well, the fact that there are certain red lines which are reinforced from the outside is beneficial, is stabilizing, and has positive impact. Of course, we have to be more discriminative. So one thing is the European Union, another thing is NATO, which also has, at least in terms of security, very important role for the member states. Much weaker function is played by an institution like the Council of Europe. So the Council of Europe, apart from legal and hard political institution, is also aspirational institution. So it creates, it strives to create something which we might call common European constitutional law. So parts of this law are hard law, the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. Parts are soft law, like Venice Commission decisions, guidelines, the OSCE and ODIHR play a role there as well in creating standards and so on. The impact of this institution, I think, has to be treated separately, and you could argue here both ways, because the idea is to keep on board countries which do not fully meet these criteria, but simply to engage in dialogue with them and keep them on board, and hopefully, and to hope that they're going to progress in the implementation of these criteria. Now we face a very difficult situation on that front, because having the case of Russia, which openly disregards such principles, with in fact what we can call aggression in the Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea and so on. These are kind of open violations of principles. So one of the hard choices will be what to do with Russia. Can this approach be sustained any further? Is it productive? Is it not? I put it there. So the next issue that I want to discuss, the next set of factors, is the nature of the electoral systems. And Rebecca actually spoke about this yesterday. I personally don't have a very... I can't draw a conclusion on this, whether one system or another definitely stabilizes or destabilizes the situation. Yes, this is an important factor. I don't believe that the electoral system per se is such an independent factor on its own that it could change the character easily of a political system. But what we can conclude by looking at least at the Eastern European countries is that there are successful models with proportional representation. Many of the countries, especially these parliamentary countries, they work on the basis of parliamentary proportional representation. And proportional representation per se has not been the culprit for a conflict. I can't think of a situation in the region where the PR system could be blamed for the existence the emergence of a conflict. Similarly, there are no such links which I could draw with first past the post, which is untypical of the region. Anyhow, normally it comes as a together in a mixed system, together with PR system. Russia, this was the original Russian system of elections for the Duma in the beginning. Now in Ukraine they use such a mixed system. Hungary, interestingly, has a mixed system in which there are there are single member districts combined with proportional representation. And the effect there has been actually to give the opportunity for a political party, Fidesz, to have 2/3 majority when it controls much less of the popular vote. So, in fact, in certain circumstances, you could have huge deviations by the majoritarian element in the system, which I don't see how they help stabilize. Yeah, they create super majorities, but they destabilize domestic politics in a very serious way. So the balance is. But let's discuss this. I mentioned this argument. For instance, in my country, if we overnight adopt the British electoral system, we'll end up with two parties. One of them, Bulgarian ethnic party, and in some regions, we'll have Turkish minority party control. So this will be a crazy map, political map of the country, and I'm not sure it will help anyhow political stability. So these are my point. Probably here will be that this is a rather contextual issue. So we can't start from the electoral system and say, look. There is a clear correlation between stability and one or another system. It's rather the discussion of the electoral system has to be put in context. And the other thing is that what I have noticed is that Whenever a country has a proportional representation system, it discusses the introduction of majoritarian very actively, and vice versa. So generally there is happiness about the electoral system, which, in my opinion, doesn't go... it's not linked to the electoral systems per se, but with it's linked with the general dissatisfaction with representative democracy. So everywhere we have low trust in political parties and in parliaments. For instance, in the UK, trust in political parties in 2011 was 11%. In the same year, in Bulgaria, trust in political parties was 14%. So we were better than UK in trust in political parties. But this means that people are generally dissatisfied with the system of representation. And from there, you get all these debates. And they're ongoing. So there is no end to that. Now... Now we come to the nature of political parties, and this was an issue which was discussed yesterday. The issue of secessionist parties was raised, and in Europe, at least when we look at the jurisprudence of the ECHR and this common European constitutional law which emerges, the position is that secessionist parties per se should be allowed only when they are linked to violence, essentially, like in the Batasuna case, they could be banned. So banning is a last instance instrument. It should be used only when there is link to other problems and violence. So not just other problems, but violence per se. Well, this link, as was said yesterday, might not be that direct. So it's not necessary for the political parties to be armed themselves and to carry out terroristic acts, but they should at least have clear position on the use of political violence in society. So this is what follows from the Batasuna judgment. Okay, so this is the general position, and now we get a very nuanced picture. For instance, the Bulgarian constitution bans ethnic and religious political parties, and this has been a point of tension between us and the Council of Europe. And the Bulgarian Constitutional Court has solved this to an extent by saying that ethnic and religious political parties are those first which are exclusive. So they don't allow people from other ethnicity or other denominations to be members. And they have, in order to be banned, to present certain danger to the constitutional order. So this has been the position since 1992 of the Constitutional Court, and it has managed. It's not a perfect marriage, but it has managed somehow to alleviate the criticism from the ECHR. So there is the issue of regional parties, and Russia had an interesting case before the ECHR, the Republican Party case. The question was whether Russia can, in fact, prevent effectively the creation of regional parties by requiring a representation of parties in most of the subjects of the federation. Actually, the law on federal parties required that in order to have a federal party, you have to have 50,000 signatures, and most of them have to be from a specific number of the subjects of the federation, so that they have coverage not only in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but in the country as well. So Russia, you know, it's a very big country, so that's not very easy to achieve. And as a result, there were six parties registered, four of which made it to the Duma. And in fact, on top of this, Russia had a very high electoral threshold for entering the Duma. So out of the registered six parties, only four managed to get over the threshold. So the ECHR took an issue with this and found the Russian regime of registration of parties in violation. And generally, the position is that that you could have regional parties, although some constitutions of countries in the broader European area try to outlaw such regional parties, and there is a point of tension there. And the final type. So we have ethnic parties, regional parties, and the most important, in my view, development in the region is the so-called populist parties, which emerge. So much of politics now is not so much left or right in terms of traditional political economy. It's not about left or right values. It's rather populist types of mobilization, which hurl around two issues. One is nationalism of one sort or another, and the second is anti-corruption. So these are the parties that you get. So some are nationalistic, others are anti-corruption, and third, you have combination of both, nationalist and anti-corruption players. So what does this spell? I'm not going to enter here about the details of this rise of the populist party as a successful type of political mobilization. We can definitely register this phenomenon. It's typical both for successful and not so successful Eastern European countries. So populism has managed to affect even countries which have been considered to be on the front runners in terms of European integration and so on. And we have spectacular examples like, I'll mention again Hungary with Fidesz, but not only Fidesz, Jobbik. So the party scene is dominated there by parties which might be usefully classified in this way. For instance, a very revealing thing was that Jobbik was, at the last parliamentary election, was the second party in the single-member districts everywhere in the country, apart for a few districts in Budapest, actually. So it's not only Fidesz, but Jobbik, the kind of the hard nationalistic party, is also very, very strong. But such type of populist players, they emerge everywhere. I'm not going to entertain you with our broad kind of broad selection of populist parties in Bulgaria, but you can find them in virtually all Eastern European countries, and some of the Western European countries, even in this country. So there is and this is interesting actually. When we started speaking and discussing the issue of populism, this was 2006, 2007 here in Oxford. Nobody was really interested in that. Now British people look more favorably at this type of discussion, you know, find more use in them. And in fact, this was my experience in countries like Greece, Spain. So just 3 or 4 years ago, this was non-issue there. But now you see that many of the parties which emerge are exactly of this type. So what does this tell us about stability and instability? It tells us that at least one of the stabilizing factors in the region, which has been the European Union and so on, has an important challenge to face, because many of these populist players are nationalistic in their nature, and they might present a challenge to European integration. It's not always like that. Still, in some countries, you have populist pro-European parties, and my country is an example. And this is still because people there trust more the European Union than local elites. And in a number of Eastern European countries, you have this inverse relationship. So trust in the European Union is higher than trust in local elites. But there is an erosion in this as well, and we don't know how long this is going to last.
Daniel, you're going to finish soon, aren't you?
I'm finishing, actually. I have just one other point to add. And this is, well, I already raised the point of distrust of representative forms of democracy. So people generally, they are pro-democratic. If you put them the question, are you supporting democracy or some alternative form of government, the majorities are going to say we're for democracy. So in a sense, democracy is the only game in town. But when you ask them, are you happy with what you get in terms of representative democracy? Are you happy with parliaments? Are you happy with parties? They say no. And this is pretty much universal. So it's not only for Eastern Europe, it's for the West as well. Curiously, trust has shifted to other forms of communication and authority. For instance, if you look the trust in TV, everywhere it's much, much higher than trust in politics. So the average is over, for the European Union, the average is over 50% trust in TV and some other social networks and other means of media information. While in the traditional elements of representative democracy, like parties, parliaments, it's very low universally. And for instance, in Greece, in 2011, again, the time of crisis, trust in political parties was 5%, in parliament, 6%, or something like that, you can imagine. In TV was also very low, but 22, so several times higher. Yeah, and in Bulgaria and some other countries like Finland, Sweden, and so on, trust in TV 73-75%, which is almost kind of extraordinary level of trust. And the average for Europe, 50%. So what does this tell us? It tells us that we are facing new forms of political mobilization, not through the traditional channels of democracy, but on the basis of media interaction, social media, and so on. And many of the protests, actually, which have emerged in a lot of countries, are, to an extent, the result of this first great dissatisfaction with traditional parties. Because if we take the Maidan, yes, it was about Europe, it was against Yanukovych, but there was also a kind of anti-party sentiment, this dissatisfaction with the political elite. What Andrew said, that Ukrainians are not terribly happy with their political elites, the parties, and so on. And this was an expression of protest against the corruption of the elite, unrepresentative character, and so on. And if you look, if you move to other countries where protests have happened, you see a similar phenomenon. So protests normally are not partisan in a sense directly related to one party or another. They, in many countries, they take the form against all parties. So this makes them unproductive, because you don't know really what these people want and what they're going to end up with. But also it shows that there is a problem with representative government as it exists now. And it puts a lot of pressure on political parties to reform and to take on board such criticism. How they take it on board is not always beneficial for democracy. For instance, this rise of populist parties is an attempt of the traditional parties to adapt to new reality. So what the populist parties do, they shed much of the traditional established ideology, they shed much of the political structures of traditional parties, they start to interact directly with the people through social media and so on. They become reflective of popular attitudes. They don't educate the people. They take whatever works and whatever is popular at the moment. So this makes the party structure very responsive, but also it creates other problems. It creates problems of governance. So you're not sure actually what this party stands for, what it's going to defend when it comes in office, does it have the proper expertise, and so on and so forth, and all other problems. So this is another aspect which in fact affects the stability of constitutional regimes. And I finish with protest because this is an expression of instability. So I try to put protest in a broader kind of framework in order to understand the origins and what why it happens in the forms it happens and so on. But generally, this will be my broad overview. It's more questions rather than answers that I have, but I think that these are important variables, important dimensions at which we can discuss the question of constitutional stability.